That's one of the amazing things about the Making of Empire Strikes Back book. The digital version has a bunch of audio clips of like people talking about stuff. I'm like, I'm glad somebody recorded these things, because here they are having actual conversations about making this movie, and they don't, people have recollections like, oh, I talked to them about this. Guess what? We've got audio too. You know, 15 minutes of audio about this one thing, and it's great to hear, even though the quality is terrible because it was the 80s.
That's true of many things in the 80s.
But not Empire Strikes Back. That was in the 80s, and it was great.
Yeah, so are me and Casey.
Yeah. So young, so young.
I feel like I have spoken to Marco and John both extremely recently and also not in weeks, because we saw each other 3 days ago. Is that right?
Something like that.
Yeah, and yet at the same time we haven't had the opportunity to really and truly nerd out for a couple of weeks now.
I like how when we tried to talk about computer stuff, we were all together. Like everyone else did not want to hear it. Everyone else, it was there. Or just like rolling their eyes and trying to change a subject to anything else.
Yeah, they effectively said with body language, save it for the show.
Mm-hmm.
And also, happy birthday, John Siracusa.
Hey!
Yay!
It's a little bit late at this point. It is 4 days ago now, but happy birthday. You are the answer to, what is the actual phrasing? The answer to life, the universe, and everything?
Yeah, pretty much.
Fair enough. All right. Do we have any pre-show banter? We just want to go straight to follow-up.
I think that was the pre-show banter.
Fair enough. All right. Let's talk about the Naked Robotic MacBook Pro, Mr. Siracusa.
Bestest thing ever.
It was said with not an ounce of sarcasm.
I think it is. I think it is pretty neat. If someone had posted this as a joke a couple weeks ago, I think we all would have had a good laugh about it.
Yep.
The first time I saw this, I thought it was a joke, and I was like, it's not April 1st. Like, I guess somebody just has bad joke timing.
Yeah, but, you know, it is apparently a real thing. This is from OWC, our friends at OWC, Otherworld Computing. This is a product that you can't buy yet, right? They've just sort of announced it, and more details to follow. You take your new slim 4 USB port MacBook Pro that we've talked about at length on this show, and you sit it on top of an aluminum rectangle that's the exact size and shape as the bottom of the MacBook Pro, making your very slim 2016/2017 model MacBook Pro the thickness of a 2012 MacBook Pro. And in the process, it gives you a bunch of extra ports on the side. You get USB Type-A ports, you get Ethernet, you get an SD card slot, you get another USB-C. As far as I can tell, you don't get any additional battery.
It does claim also 4 terabytes of internal storage of some type.
And additional things to come. Like they haven't revealed all the things it's going to do. So right away, I have some technical questions about this.
Oh, yes.
My first, how does it work? Because I expected it to plug into the USB-C ports on the side. Because you know you can do that, like the Thunderbolt/USB-C ports. If you can plug, for example, a Thunderbolt 3 dock into there, and on that dock you can have an SD card port and USB ports and storage, and you know you can do all these. We know you can do it, but you have to plug into one of those ports. And the pictures they have show both sides of this thing with all 4 of the Thunderbolt 3 ports on the side of this MacBook Pro completely open. So that's mysterious.
No, I don't think it's mysterious at all. I mean, I understand what you're saying, but I will bet you a gazillion dollars that if you're looking at the images of the two sides, so they're showing the right-hand side of it, but it's on the left-hand side of the image, and then the left-hand side on the right-hand side of the image. So the right side of the dock where the SD card is, there's a USB C port directly under one of the 4 onboard USB-C ports. It's hard to paint a word picture about this, but anyway, I bet you anything they're going to have one of those little stubby USB-C cables right there. It'll be like you remember the daughter board video cards from PCs way back in the day, where you would go like VGA from your 2D card.
John doesn't remember.
Yeah, you go from VGA from your 2D card to your 3D card, and then VGA from your 3D card out to your monitor, and they would have these little like stubby VGA cables. It was barbaric. But
so I'm gonna make an even older reference. Back in the Mac days, when they had SCSI as their external connector for hard drives and such, and you would buy hard drives that fit exactly underneath the classic Mac shape, so you'd stack them and they would be exactly the size of the base of like a Mac Plus or a 512 or whatever. And since you would stack them, each one would be a different hard drive, and you need to daisy chain them together in typical Scuzzy fashion, one would have a terminator and then you'd go from one to the other. They made C-shaped brackets that were not cables at all, but were exact brackets. You know, a single manufacturer would sell them, like Jasmine or whatever, and they would plug into the back and connect one drive to the one right above it, exactly matching these gigantic 50-pin Scuzzy connectors. So not a cable at all, but a very stiff brackety type thing. And I can imagine that as well, but they don't show it in the pictures.
Correct. That is fair.
Well, and also, these pictures should be taken with a huge grain of salt because they have even stated these are renderings. These are not the final product. And in fact, when I first looked at this page, maybe an hour before that Mac Rumors article was posted, these exact pictures in this exact spot on the official OWCDigital.com/DEC on that page, these exact pictures, the two sides were blank except for one, the one single USB-C in port. And the card reader was there, but all the USB-A and the Ethernet port you see right there were not there like 12 hours ago. So clearly, like, this is a work in progress. Like, I learned more from the Mac Rumors post about it than I did from their page. So clearly, this is still in the very early phases. They said it will be available in 2017, but I don't think they got more specific than that, nor have they listed a price or anything. But yeah, I mean, it's basically, yeah, it's a docking station that happens to be the same shape as the MacBook Pro, so you can sit it on top of it. But when I first saw these pictures without seeing the Mac Rumors article, when I first saw the pictures and got almost no information, I assumed that what they were doing was basically offering a service where you could send your MacBook to them and they would like unscrew the bottom of it,
yeah,
and replace semi-permanently attach this thing. And if they were doing that, then they could maybe do something like give a bigger battery and use internal, whatever kind of internal connections that are present, if any. I honestly would be surprised if there are many, if any, but
yeah, I was thinking where would they connect it internally, but you can do a bigger battery with it external too, because remember that USB-C port is also the charging port, so it works sure. Like the smartphone iPhone case or whatever,
exactly, battery case. But anyway, that isn't what this is as far as we can tell from the very little information we have. But either way, so basically it sounds like it almost certainly doesn't offer any additional battery power, and that's the only real reason I would see for wanting to have this tremendous additional bulk added permanently to your MacBook,
we don't know, because they say right. More stuff is coming, and if you look at the stuff that's in there, obviously there has to be more, because the stuff they have in there would not take up all that space. So I guess it could just be filled with air, but if you're going to put a battery, it's not like there's not room.
They could put an optical drive. No,
I actually thought the same thing, believe it or not.
They could put a really good keyboard that you can't reach. We'll see when this thing actually provides a little more information and when it actually launches, but I don't think the market for this is going to be very big. I certainly won't use it. No way you can make me use that, because the fact is that the MacBook Pro as it is almost pretty good, and this pushes it so far in the other direction that it's like, okay, this, like, you've turned something that's almost pretty good but has mediocre battery life and a bad keyboard into something that is still having mediocre battery life and a bad keyboard that is just like bigger and heavier to add what is really a very small handful of capabilities so far. I don't see why people would want this, honestly, but somebody might, I guess.
Well, remember, Marco, that you cannot possibly do any kind of work on a MacBook Pro unless you have an SD card slot. So if you wanted to do any kind of work on a MacBook Pro, you must have this dock. Otherwise, it's impossible.
No, and honestly, so in the massive span of time since we've last spoken on this podcast, I did we traveled upstate for parent Christmas stuff, and I had my laptop there. And there was one point in which I had brought some. Every year we make a Christmas video, and from the previous Christmases, photos and time lapse. Tiff does all the work; she gets all the credit. Anyway, I bring with me on my laptop copies of all the videos, so that way when we get there after we've shown it to everybody, we can then give everybody their own copy
on the thumb drives that don't go into your computer.
Yeah. So one of the film members has an iPad, one has a laptop, and one has a thumb drive. So this is okay. This is like how you put the wolf on the boat, and it's like it's this crazy thing. It's like, yeah,
put the wolf in with the chicken,
right? It's like how do we get these files to these different things, right? I'm sitting there on the couch with my new MacBook, and first my father-in-law brings down the Lightning card reader adapter with an SD card in it that he uses in his iPad. He's like, can you put it on here? And I look at the Lightning, And I look at the SD card. And I'm like, nope. And then like my and then I get handed this like USB key, like this USB thumb drive thing. No, I guess I got to get a dongle for that. Like I go upstairs, get the dongle, and it's like, and it wasn't that I didn't own the dongle. And it wasn't that I didn't even have the dongle, like, technically with me on the trip, but it was upstairs, and I was downstairs, and I was on a soft couch, and it was Christmas. There's just going to be so many of these times with these new MacBook Pros where, like, even if it's a minor inconvenience, it still makes you regret the limitations of this computer in use, in practice. I bet more often than Apple might have estimated by whatever data they were using to make this decision to omit all the useful stuff from this computer. And there are so many things about it that are nice. Like it, like every, you know, every year we go to the same place, my in-laws' place, and every year I have to plug in my laptop. And every year I had this weird layout where to reach the left side of where the charging port was, where MagSafe was, I have to kind of lean the laptop in a strange way overnight when it's charging. And this year I could use the other side, which was really helpful. And there's going to be times like that where it's nice to have charging on either side. Like, that would be great, right? So, you know, it isn't all bad. And it was also really nice to have this thing be lighter. As I was carrying it around the house and, you know, doing, you know, basic stuff, like it was nice having it lighter. So I appreciate those things, and I appreciate some of the progress. But boy, not having the SD card reader and at least one USB-A port has already bitten me, like, more than once in these, like, little tiny, like, you know, razor blade cut ways. Like, just, it doesn't leave me with a good taste in my mouth about this laptop overall.
So I think this product, however it turns out to be in the market, reveals some interesting things that we've talked about before, but this is like a concrete version of it. The first is this is an extreme case of the naked robotic core thing applied to the Mac, which we talked about before. The idea that if you just provide the core amount of functionality and let people add stuff on top of that they might want. So with the iPhone, it's like we give you the skinniest little metal thing that you want. And if you want extra battery, or you want more protection, or, you know, you want a place to put your credit cards, or you want a rubbery outside, or whatever it is that you want to do to it, everyone else can bring to it whatever they want. You want it to be a different color, or a different texture, or whatever, you can put that on. But by making the smallest thing possible, we let the people who want a really small thing have a really small thing, and people who want something different, everyone can apply. Because if we made a choice and added the big battery, the people who wanted the skinnier ones can have it, and so on and so forth. So this thing being the naked robotic MacBook Pro, if you want a bunch of ports, you can slap it on the end. And all the past times we've talked about this is like, yeah, but if you add it on the outside, because you have to have, you know, phone, motherboard, battery, case, you know, inner case, battery, outer case, like the extra layering requiring them both to be products in and of themselves. The case is a product and the phone is a product, and they have their own walls, and the combination of all the walls is your total thickness. It makes them bigger than if you said, if you just took that amount of battery that's in this battery case and put it inside the phone, it wouldn't be as thick. So here we have a great example of that. These ports that they're adding, if Apple had put these inside the MacBook Pro, it would be thicker, but it would not be this thick. I mean, you can look at it. They have the Ethernet port is stacked up with the USB-C ports above it, like, because they can't add, you know, they can't violate the integrity of the case. So you've got the entire flat side thickness of the case, and then what they have left to put their ports on is anything they can put below that. They can't combine them. So this does show a very graphic illustration of the highlight of the naked robotic core strategy is that if you do add stuff, it will always necessarily be bigger than if it was built in. And the second thing I think is that, I don't know if this was just someone making an estimation or if they say it in the copy as a real thing, but I believe it. They're saying this makes your 2016/2017 MacBook Pro the same thickness as the 2012 model. But we all look at this and it looks like that comical illustration of the PowerBook G5. Do you remember that? That Photoshop? It looks like it's just comically thick. Like it's like the size of a dictionary or a phone book. I don't know if kids know what those are. It's a really thick book. It looks huge, and yet this was the thickness of a product that Apple sold not too long ago. 2012 MacBook Pro that people still have and like, and often they say, I'm sticking with my 2012 MacBook Pro because it's got all the ports I want or whatever. This, I think, illustrates what I always talked about in that Hypercritical post long ago about people complaining that the iMac was getting too skinny when they took away the optical drive and made it super skinny. It's like, who the hell needs a super skinny iMac? What's the point? And I transferred over to the iPhone to say, look, you have to go thinner year after year, because even though from year to year, the sacrifice doesn't make that much of a difference, you think, oh, what? So it's a few millimeters thicker. Multiply that by year after year after year, and you will find yourself far from where you started. So in 2012, them shaving another millimeter off 2013, another millimeter off in 2014, it seems like, what's the point? You're just making my thing thinner in a way that I can't even detect, and I'm not getting any gains from it. But like you said, Marco, you appreciate the lightness, even just compared to your previous model, which wasn't that old. Imagine what it would be like if you upgraded from a 2012 model to this. And here we have a rewind button to go back to what it was like in 2012. And now you can't go back. Now you say, no, that's too far. I can't go back that far. I don't care how many ports you have. It is too big and it is too heavy. I know now that I know what's possible, I can't go back to that again. So there is something to be said for Apple's relentless pursuit of thinness. I still don't think they've hit any sort of inflection point. Like the thing that I always go back to is the credit card size phone that just flutters to the ground and you don't have to worry about it cracking, because no one worries about dropping their credit card on the ground and cracking it because it's so freaking thin. We haven't got there yet. We're not even close. But this illustration and our general disgust with it, this product and our disgust with how thick it is, really hammers home that this thinness thing, even though we complain about it, the upsides aren't just academic. Like, once you become accustomed to it being that thin, we want it to be that thin and also maybe have an SD card slot, which, by the way, they could totally do because there's plenty of room. Okay. Or add 2 millimeters back. Like, you know, we're willing to bargain a millimeter too, but none of us want to add, you know, half an inch to this thing because we just can't go back to that.
By the way, I can't let this go without pointing out that this ancient, thick 2012 MacBook Pro that they're comparing this to was sold in the form of the 101 until like 2 months ago.
Yeah, had an optical drive, plenty of room in there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, but I mean, you're right. Like, I love the 2012 Retina MacBook Pro. Like, the 15-inch Retina, it's so, so nice. It's such an overall awesome machine. But now that I've had this new one for 1 month, the old one, which I still have in my closet because I haven't sold it yet, I look at it and I pick it up every so often, and, like, it feels ancient. And it feels like a big, heavy, awkward lunch tray, even though, like, a month ago, I was like, this is fine. This doesn't need to get any smaller. Like, it really is all about what you're accustomed to. And as soon as you get accustomed to this new one, even though the difference is in weight and in thickness is not tremendous, it is a savings that is noticeable. And as soon as you start noticing it, it's really hard to ever go back and to have it feel normal. I mean, heck, even the keyboard. I hate the keyboard on the new one. But when I use the keyboard on the old one, I'm like, this is kind of mushy. Like, I'm ruined. Yep. I'm completely ruined. I still hate the new one, keyboard-wise.
Right.
But it's like, and honestly, I think I would hate the new keyboard a lot less if they would give me back the gaps above the left and right arrow keys.
Mm-hmm.
That has bitten me more than any other thing about this keyboard. Like, the key switches, I still don't like, but I've gotten used to. Escape, I have mapped to caps lock, and it was a very easy transition. The shaping of those arrow keys and not having the little gaps above left and right the way they have been for years, that keeps messing me up so much because I can no longer orient myself on the arrow keys by feel reliably. And this, as it turns out, this is something I need quite frequently in use. I didn't realize it, you know, until I used one of these things for a while. But wow, that is a big change. But yeah, when you go back to the old one, it's like, wow, I don't want, even though it is in so many ways better, you know, you use the quote mushy keyboard and you see the relatively tiny little, you know, quaint little trackpad on there. And you're like, wow, this is like using a PowerBook by comparison. the new thing really does feel so much newer and more modern, even though in these fairly large ways, it is definitely worse.
This is one of the dangers of using iOS or growing up with iOS. When I watch my son, he's mostly the one who has to do school assignments, like they use Google Docs and he writes school papers and stuff in it, which is a pretty good system in terms of letting, you know, teachers and peers, you know, comment on and see their work. Anyway, because he's a child of iOS and a child of the post-PC age, watching him try to use a word processor on a Mac just makes me want to tear my hair out because all of his cursor movement he does with the mouse.
Oh.
And I'm like, see these keys on the keyboard with the arrows on them? I swear to you, they will move the insertion point one character easier than you finding where the mouse is, steering your, because he's not good with the mouse either, steering your cursor over, moving it over to, it's like, just use the mouse. You don't even say like option or command arrows, just plain use the arrow key. Like, it is so much faster, and forward delete, and just like these amazing technologies that, like, watching him try to do text editing, because all he's ever used to is the terrible text editing on iOS, where you have to hold your stupid finger down, you get that magnifying glass, that also makes me want to tear my hair out. But even after I show him the arrow keys, it's not like he's like, thanks, Dad, that's a revelation, I'm so much more efficient. He's like, no, I'll go back to the mouse.
Yeah.
So painful. I don't know how kids these days, someday they'll learn about arrow keys.
We are sponsored this week by Betterment. Go to betterment.com/ATP to learn more and get up to 6 months of no fees. Betterment, investing made better. Betterment has changed the financial industry by making investing easier and at a lower cost than most traditional financial advisors. They manage your investments with the same strategies that these advisors use with clients who have millions of dollars. You might have actually heard about this in the press, such as the Wall Street Journal, Bloomberg, and TechCrunch, that have all covered Betterment. Betterment is an independent automated investing service, and it's the largest independent automated investing service, managing more than $5.5 billion for over 180,000 customers as of this past fall. Now, the financial services industry has embraced technology and innovation through the creation of these automated investing services, meaning that you keep more of your money with fees that are a fraction of what you could pay for traditional financial services and their advisors. And excess cash that your investments generate is automatically reinvested, so every dollar you invest is put to work all the time, and your portfolio is automatically rebalanced. So check it out today. Go to betterment.com/ATP to learn more and get up to 6 months of no fees. Investing involves risk. Once again, go to betterment.com/ATP. That's betterment.com/ATP. Betterment, investing made better.
On pros leaving the Mac, apparently somebody has done a little bit of polling and research about whether or not designers would ever consider, motion designers specifically, whatever that means, would you ever consider switching to a PC? Yes, 42%, maybe 40%, no, 18%.
I threw this in there just to reinforce the idea. I said last show that, like, professional users whose job is to do, like, motion graphics, they're not Mac users, they're motion graphic designers, right? This is what they do. I think this means, like, motion and video, you know, like, basically video effects or transitions during the news or whatever. I think that's what this means. This is what this website is about. It's called schoolofmotion.com. So it's entirely a professional website for people who do this for a living. It's not about Macs. It's not about computers. It's not about what tool you use to do for a living. It's like, I want to do this for a living, and then they talk about the tools that they use. So they want to get the job done. They don't necessarily care about any particular one. So the survey was, would you consider switching to PC? So it shows that in general, the bent of the site, it's like, oh, we mostly use Macs to do this. And we talk about programs that are available on the Mac to do it. Like Motion, I think is still for sale. Anyway, would you consider switching to PC? 82% are either yes or maybe. Only 18% say no. Because the bottom line is, it's like, well, if that's the way I have to go to do motion graphics, I will do it, because, you know, they're not going to change their profession because the computer they like doesn't let them do what they do. They're going to change platform. So, you know, and again, like I said on the last show, it doesn't mean that every company that tries to make that transition will be successful. It's very, you know, disruptive to have to buy all new hardware and learn new programs and buy new licenses and deal with, you know, file formats and legacy data and all that other stuff. But in general, if a company doesn't serve a professional market like that, the market will switch very quickly, because the market is not sentimental. Individual people may be sentimental. Even whole companies can be sentimental. But the market, in terms of, I need a bunch of people to do job X for me with computers, is not sentimental. And if you don't do the job, someone else will. And whatever tool gets the job done.
All right. So the next item in the list scares me deeply.
Me too.
It says Casey and Marco's homework, and I think I can speak for Marco in saying, well, maybe that I don't remember, that might be just me, but I can speak for Marco in saying, I didn't do my homework. So what was I supposed to? What was I supposed to have been doing?
That could always speak for me, Casey.
Right, that part I was confident. It was the remembering part I wasn't as sure about.
I also don't remember what the homework was.
I felt bad because I was listening back to the show. Well, so people were tweeting at us, like, I can't wait to hear Casey and Marco on their homework. And by that point, I'd forgotten what I had assigned to you for homework. But I remember doing it, but I did it mostly as a joke, because we know that you guys don't do any homework. So when I was listening back to the show, as I do, I was reminded of what the homework was. But listeners, maybe they're new listeners. They somehow thought that you were going to actually do this homework. A, remember what the homework was. Yeah, no. And B, come to the show ready to have the homework was...
It's very optimistic.
Yeah. The homework was the idea of trying to figure out how you would distinguish between a situation where the world is moving on from PCs and we are just being left behind because we're dinosaurs, or a situation where Apple is foolishly abandoning the Mac market, even though the concept of a PC-style computer has many, many years to go and Apple is making a mistake. And the idea from the perspective of someone who loves a Mac, those can both look the same from the inside. What might you look for? What might you look for from the inside to try to distinguish those two situations? Is there something, because they feel the same and they look the same, but is there some kind of thing you could look at to say, okay, well, if it was the case that we were being left behind as dinosaurs, we would see this. But if it turns out that Apple's actually making a mistake, we would see that instead. Is there anything we can look for to let us know which those two things are? And couldn't think of anything on the show, and so I signed it as homework, and you two probably forgot about it. But I don't suppose you have any new interesting thoughts on it now.
Not really. I mean, I don't really care what the difference there is. I want what I want, and if Apple is not going to provide it, I'm going to yell about it.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's true. Like, I'm not saying you don't have to yell. I'm just saying, like, I think it's interesting, too, because I am interested in whether it's the most difficult to be objective about something that, you know, you care deeply about. But it makes you kind of an enemy of progress if, you know, if the buggy whip salesman or whatever, it's like, you know, or... as Casey was saying, the stick shift thing, where if, you know, are you using your influence to actually stop the future from coming, or are you right and that's not actually the future and really Apple's just doing something dumb? And I think it makes a difference because I don't want to use all my power and influence and arguing skills to try to hold back progress, right? So I would like to know if I am, you know, not that I'm not going to be upset about it, but I would like to know if I am actually the enemy of progress here by clinging to the idea of the personal computer, right? And so I'm interested in being able to determine what the situation is. Now, I feel like I'm not particularly strongly on either side of this, so I don't think this is, for me personally, a situation, and maybe Marco doesn't care, but I think it is... I think it's a thing worth considering for all, not just for you know, silly, neglecting the Mac things, but for all things of this type, especially as we get older. Very often what you really don't want is for things to be different than you're used to. And it's very easy to decide that your desire to not have things change trumps everything else. And that's not, you know, I believe in progress, and I constantly want to make sure that I am not slowly shifting to the opposite side of progress, because when you see that from the outside, when you see somebody who is an obvious enemy of progress and doesn't realize it, it's a pitiable situation, and I never want to be in that situation.
Well, you know, I think it's somewhat useful to look around and to see, like, all right, I have these, like, opinions on how the types of work that I do, the types of problems that I need to solve, how these things should or need to be done. You know, obviously, one of the biggest things you could say is, well, look around at other people who have similar problems. Are they insisting on the same requirements? Are they doing things that way? Or did they move to something else a long time ago and you didn't? And they are now getting along just fine without doing the same kinds of things that you want to do, but in the new, you know, quote progress way. You know, obviously it's hard to make this apply to everything. And looking around, you know, it's hard for people to have a lot of good data on, like, you know, what a lot of people are doing, because it's, you know, mostly it's just anecdotal. Well, I look around and I see, like, the other people in my office are doing this, or my parents are doing this, or my kids are doing this, or whatever. You know, you could look you have a few friends you can look at, but, like, most people have a pretty small sample group they can draw from for that kind of analysis. But I think sometimes that's enough. You know, like, I think if you can look around and you can see, like, am I the last person doing this way? You know, like, then that's probably a sign that you are on the wrong side of things. But if there's still, like, if what you are defending is still done by what seems like the majority of people who do that kind of thing, then you might still be wrong. Like, you know, you might be at the very beginning of a wave and just everyone else hasn't realized it yet either. but chances are you're probably at least a little bit right. Chances are that, you know, you're probably on the right side of that, at least for now. You know, it might be something that's really forward looking that everyone's missing, but that doesn't happen very often. Everyone thinks it happens a lot, but it doesn't happen very often in reality.
I was actually having an interesting conversation with a friend of mine earlier tonight about whether or not... Well, he said to me something I thought was very interesting, and he said desktop OSs are a solved problem. And I think he was being a little bit, I don't know if dramatic's the right word, but he was kind of playing up his point of view a little bit, right, to make a point. But he was saying, you know, desktop OSs are a solved problem. And at first I was like, what? No. God, no. What are you talking about? But as I thought about it, I still disagree with him. And again, I think he was just making the point to kind of play devil's advocate. But I understand where he's coming from in that if you look at what do we want from a desktop OS? And he asked me that, actually, and what I said to him was, I just want it not to be ignored, man. Like, I just want progress. But if you look at it, there's been progress. Like, Siri doesn't really do anything for me on the desktop, but that's progress. That's a big deal. And that's just a single data point, but it's an example of things that are happening. Everyone has been moaning lately about how Messages hasn't been touched on Sierra. That's just not right. Like the rich previews, or however you phrase it, where, for example, you paste a link to a tweet and you see the tweet in the Messages window. Like, granted, I wish I had sticker support in Sierra. Like, I totally do. I don't know that I would use it that often, but I just wish I had the support for it, right? But even something as arguably silly as rich previews and Messages makes a world of difference, and that's progress. And so, to me, I think just not even necessarily bringing iOS into macOS, but just having that continued incremental improvement, that's all I really want from a desktop OS right now. And to that end, my friend was kind of right that in a large way, it's kind of a solved problem. Now, in the next breath, I'll tell you, well, is it really a solved problem? Look at the touch bar. This is brand new paradigm that just came out. We don't really know what we're doing with that. So obviously, this is a very shaky argument. But when you compare that to iOS, where there's plenty of work left to be done, certainly iOS is, in many ways, the more interesting platform. Now, I'm not necessarily saying interesting to me. I'm not saying interesting to everyone, because personally, I still like the Mac. I still prefer the Mac. We went over this either last episode or the episode before. But there's a lot more progress to be made. And I look at people like Ben Brooks, I look at Vitici, and I look at Mike Hurley, and I see them doing everything in their jobs, or nearly everything, on iOS devices. And I come to kind of what John was saying a minute ago. Am I the one that's telling everyone to get off my lawn? Like, am I the one that's really holding on to the past? And I'm not saying that it is the case, but I am definitely wondering. And to more directly answer John's question, how do we know which one of these it is? I'm not sure. But right now, I can tell you that it seems to me like there are some pretty direct ways to accomplish things on the Mac. And I can't think of a great example off the top of my head, but there, you can accomplish a lot of things on the Mac directly, where in iOS, you need to like daisy chain 7 different apps to make the same operation happen. And that doesn't mean that iOS is wrong, but to me, as long as that's still the case, as long as you still have to write a custom workflow to get something to happen in the workflow app, which, by the way, is truly mind-boggling amazing, but as long as that's how you get things done, like that is the official way to get things done on iOS, I don't think that the Mac is dead quite yet. And I'm not even talking about like writing code or anything like that. I'm just talking about like general things that professionals do. And you can define professionals, professional podcasters, as professional project managers, as CMOs, whatever Ben Brooks's title is. I don't even remember anymore. But if they're jumping through hoops in order to get their work done, even if they don't necessarily feel like it's jumping through hoops, it's still daisy chaining a bunch of different steps together. As long as that's still a thing, I don't think the Mac is dead. But when that stops being a thing, or it becomes even easier to kind of daisy chain all these things, and you're not writing custom workflows because apps are supporting it, then I start to wonder, maybe I'm the old man here after all.
Well, this is why I think it's important to really make these observational comparisons, which I guess are called observations, on people who do the same kind of work that you do, right? Like, you know, people you mentioned are podcasters and writers, and the podcasters all still use Macs to podcast with. Not all podcasters, but the ones you mentioned. And, you know, a writer can get away with using iOS only or primarily a lot more easily than a programmer can today. And, you know, so I think once people, like, you know, you and I, all the three of us are all programmers. Once a whole bunch of programmers dump their PCs and Macs and do all of their work on iOS, then I think we have to start looking, okay, you know, there's a thing here. We should consider this. We should pay attention to this. And maybe we are wrong at that point. But until that happens, which might never come, again, I want to be very careful here in how I phrase this. Like, you know, you said, like, you know, like, you know, the Mac is dead. Mac isn't dead until this happens. And a lot of people, you know, you phrase these things in a way that presents them as an inevitable future. But I do want to be clear here that when I talk about this, I'm not necessarily considering this an inevitable future. The future, I mean, you know, obviously OSs eventually do die and you know, fall out of favor and fall out of use and maintenance. But I am still not yet convinced that the PC-style operating system is destined to be, you know, sidelined and killed in favor of the mobile style operating system within the foreseeable future. Like, eventually on an infinite time scale it might happen, but, you know, I don't see this as like the obvious, you know, foretold future that is certain to happen. But anyway, I think you really have to just look at, like, you know, people who do the kind of work you do. And most of the people who were talking about going iOS only or iOS being the inevitable future, most of these people are writers and analysts and executives, and that's fine, and there's a lot of people who that will be fine for. But if you start talking to people who do different kinds of things with their computers, including things that all three of us do, then you start very quickly to hit limits of, like, oh well, you kind of can't do that on iOS yet, or that's really difficult and clunky to do on iOS. I don't think you can look at a bunch of people who professionally write as their main job and say, like, well, they're all using iPads, therefore I should be using an iPad. You should be more concerned if people who do the kinds of things you do, like programming, if they switch, and that's when you should pay attention.
I largely agree with you, but I don't think it's fair to classify Federico, Mike, and Ben Brooks all as simply writers. I mean, I think they're doing...
I didn't say simply. That's important.
Okay,
but it's, well, no, it's a job that is very amenable to iOS primary or iOS only work. And there are a lot of jobs for which that's the case, but there's a lot where it isn't also.
Yeah, I guess my point is that I don't want to paint the image, because I can hear Mike Hurley and Federico screaming at us from the future. It's not that all they do is write, you know. It's they're doing sometimes relatively intense, you know, spreadsheet work. I mean, look at the quarterly earnings reports that Federico, you know, farts out in the span of like 4 seconds because of all the workflows that he's built. And you know, Mike and Stephen Hackett are, you know, billing or invoicing advertisers and doing all sorts of like traditional businessy things. So I agree with you that it is mostly writer-like things on the surface, but there's a lot more to it when you start digging in. But that doesn't negate your point that these people, with the exception perhaps of Federico, actually, these people are not developers. They're not writing code, well, except Federico, on their devices.
I mean, Federico's an outlier in a lot of ways.
Yeah, you know, I agree. But yeah, it's not the sort of thing that the three of us do, but I don't want to discount it in summary as legitimate work that is more than just writing prose on a piece of paper. That's all.
Oh yeah. No, and I never said legitimate or simple. Like, I'm not saying I'm not characterizing it this way. It's just different software needs and different things you need from your computing devices and different levels of like flexibility and access to things like files and inner program communication and the integration of lots of things within the same data set, like what you need with programming. And like, there, you know, there are certain strengths and weaknesses to both OS styles. But again, you know, I think when people who do the kinds of things you do are switching in mass, that's when to pay attention. before that happens and unless that happens, I don't think you need to be worried too much that you are the dinosaur holding back progress. Also, it's quite impressive that John thinks that we can hold back progress.
Well, no, I'm just saying, like, what are you spending your time doing? Because, like I said, if you see somebody yelling against it, even if they don't actually do anything, it seems like they're wasting their time, and it's a sad situation where they don't realize that the world is passing them by. One more item on this that I think about is sort of the second level version of checking yourself, which is more focused on Apple, the company, and less focused on what the future of computing is. And that is the question of whether it's important for Apple to be in the personal computer market. So even if you seed everything that Marco said, they're like, okay, well, people doing these types of jobs still need a PC or whatever. Is it the best thing for the company called Apple? Does it need to be in the PC market? And that's where we talk about, like, oh, well, they need, you know, the Macs to develop for iOS. What if they have a development environment on iPads? Well, it's not the same, blah, blah, blah. Or could you develop iOS applications on PCs? Like, that's the next question is, even if you stipulate PCs aren't going away anytime soon, should Apple continue to sell PCs? Is the Mac only hanging around for old time's sake and tradition and affection, but it would be better for the company to allow all the people who develop for iOS to do so on a platform that someone else maintains, and really, in us arguing for Apple to stay in the market, really, we're just trying, like, you know, I mean, we've made the argument a million times, so like, that every other alternative is worse, so we would be sad. But it, from the perspective of Apple, the company, they may say, yes, we agree, every alternative is worse than the Mac, but the Mac is no longer worth the money for us to invest in, and rather than letting it limp along with us never updating our stuff and you being all mad about it, why don't we just get out of that business the same way we got out of printers and Wi-Fi hubs and whatever the hell else they're not in, and won't that be refreshing? We can finally concentrate on the thing we do best, which is the iPhone with some ancillary iOS type things and blah, 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 blah. I think, you know, obviously I disagree with that or whatever, but that's I still keep it in mind as the second possibility, the first being that, you know, that, you know, we're on the wrong side of history in this, and the second is we're on the right side of history, but just because we love Apple and just because it's the best, it would actually be better for the company Apple to get out of this business so it could concentrate on the other stuff, which, again, I don't buy, but I still entertain that as a thought experiment that I revisit to make sure that it's not the case, because that can sneak up on you too, where you're like, you feel so strongly that you're right, that, like, look, everybody who is editing video is doing it on a big, powerful personal computer. Personal computers can't go away. I'm a video editor. I need to edit video. I look at all the other people who are editing video and no one's doing it on an iPad. Clearly the PC is a thing. And then to make the leap, therefore Apple needs to make a new Mac Pro. Does Apple need to make a Mac Pro, or do you just need to switch to Windows and be sad? Like, you know, because again, pros will use whatever they have to use to get the job done. And the more, like an appliance, this is what I was talking about when Marco was talking about, like, getting the Surface Studio. The more you use a computer like an appliance to get your job done as a professional, the less tied you are, effectively, if not emotionally, to the particular platform you're using. So if you're just going to be in Lightroom all day and the Surface Studio is the best, you know, dedicated Lightroom appliance, you go into the office, you sit down in front of it, and all you do is Lightroom, Lightroom, Lightroom all day long. Maybe that is better than any solution Apple has to offer, and maybe Apple staying in that business is just some sentimental thing that you care about, but realistically speaking, we would all be much happier if Apple got out of it and stopped making that line of computers entirely, and you just sat down in front of your Surface Studio and gave that business to Microsoft, some company that's actually interested in pursuing it.
Yeah, well, as soon as Apple starts being managed by the numbers that way, they're going to find themselves, I think, in a very boring and slowly declining place, whether the numbers suggest so or not. That is a very, very fast way to become Microsoft with under Steve Ballmer. I'm telling, like, that's, you know, there was this wonderful Steve Jobs video that floated around Reddit a couple weeks ago about how, like, you know, it takes like five years to realize, like, when the bit flips and you start, like, making computers just to make money and not to make better computers or something like that. I'm probably butchering it.
But he also said he would milk the Mac for all it's worth and move on to the next big thing. And guess what? The Mac it's not like an analogy. He was talking about specifically the Mac we're talking about now. Milk it for all it's worth, move on to the next thing. And it's clear he thought the next thing was the iPhone and the iPad. And it's pretty clear the next thing is the iPhone and the iPad, but we're still making Macs. So in some ways, it would be like pursuing your passion, not continuing to make the Mac just because you've always made it. If the company itself is enthusiastic about iOS devices only, then continuing to make Max in a disappointing way. You know, it's not as if like, oh, well, you're just going to go, if you're going to go by the numbers, you're like, oh, I should go where the big business is. But maybe the passion is just not in it anymore for the Max. Maybe they see it as a declining business that they're not interested in. And isn't it better for all of us to divorce this dysfunctional relationship, stop making the Mac, force everybody to go to Windows, which will force more money into that market that will hopefully motivate Microsoft to make the Surface Studio better. You know, I'm not recommending any of this. It's just, these are all thought experiments and all things that I revisit and mostly reject, but if you never revisit them, they'll sneak up on you.
Well, but here's the problem with this thinking. So you start running the company by the numbers and you think, well, it'll be fine. We'll, you know, we'll let the Mac languish, or we'll kill it because it's not, you know, it's not where we want to go, or whatever. Whatever the reason, doesn't matter.
But it's not by the numbers, as they're not passionate about it. It's the past, and they're passionate about the future. So they're running it by their passion. They're not being a slave to the past. They're saying what we are interested in is, I don't know, maybe they're interested in AR or whatever. But you know, that maybe they're not interested in the Mac anymore. So I would say it's the opposite of running it by the numbers, because the numbers would tell you, why throw away a $22 billion business, right? That's free money. Why are you throwing that away? You say, we're throwing it away so we can concentrate more fully on the thing that we really believe is the future, which is the opposite of Steve Ballmer. Steve Ballmer would keep the Mac going forever and just do exactly what the customers wanted forever and ever as the rest of the world moves on. You know what I mean? I feel like that's more of the Steve Ballmer way.
You're right. Apple would definitely not keep selling the same products forever.
No, I mean, like, in terms of, like, you know, of trying to do what that market wants exactly. Like, they would be giving us Big Macs with lots of ports and, you know, constantly revising them and just, making them satisfied in the way that, like, you know, IBM mainframe customers are satisfied. That IBM will continue to make mainframes for its mainframe customers and give them exactly what they want, all the while the whole rest of the world is moving on from mainframes. But they don't know. They're like, it's fine. You know, they keep making us better and better mainframes, and we love mainframes. And they wake up one day, and the entire world has moved on. And they're like, wait, there's only like 10 of us left? But we were so happy for all these years, and we were happy to give IBM all this money, and they kept making these awesome mainframes for us, and the world has moved on past you, right? So that, I feel like that's more of a Ballmer thing.
Fair, but everything you're saying about the Mac, what happens when they apply that exact same logic to the iPhone?
Well, they can. I mean, if they're no longer passionate about the iPhone and they think the next big thing is something else, you know, then they should, like, it's exactly the same thing as Steve Jobs saying, like, milk the Mac for all it's worth, move on to the next big thing. Eventually, it's milk the iPhone for all it's worth, move on to the next big thing. Because if you don't, someone else will. Like, someone else will eat your lunch if you don't eat, you know, cannibalizing your business. Apple is the one who cannibalized its own iPod sales. If Apple didn't cannibalize iPod sales, the sales curve for iPods would look like the same big hump with spikes on it for the holidays. It would look exactly the same. But someone else would have replaced it, whether it's Samsung or Microsoft or whoever would have won that war. If Apple didn't cannibalize the iPod, someone else would. So it's not like Apple banked the company on the iPod and said it's going to be iPod forever. And remember when people were saying the iPod is going to dwarf the Mac, and now Apple is just an iPod company and the Apple store was the iPod store, right? Apple is the one who cannibalized the iPod. It turns out the iPod arc was obviously shorter than we think the iPhone arc is going to be. The iPhone arc could last our whole lives for all we know, right? Or longer. But that's the challenge, you know, the innovator's dilemma and all that other crap. That's the challenge of business. And the Mac in all of these graphs is this aberration that never goes up and never goes down, but just keeps on trucking. And I think they're, you know, I'm playing devil's advocate. I'm just saying, like, these are things that are worth thinking about. I don't find them convincing. If I had to make the argument, I would say Apple needs to continue making the Mac and should do a much better job at it because the time has not come. Because I'm on the same page as Marco. Like, other people who are doing these tasks are not currently using anything that's not like a PC. They're using PCs to do them. Like, they're not using Surface tablets. They're not using, at this point, they're still not using the Surface Studio. They're using PCs, whether they're Windows PCs or Unix workstations running Maya or Macs. They're just not using iPads to do these jobs, right? And that's, I think that is, you know, Marco didn't do his homework, but he came up with a pretty reasonable last minute scribbling while the teacher's coming around and collecting the papers.
That's how I got through school.
Yeah, I think that is a thing to look for. And you have to be careful, because if you're just looking at the people who are like hanging out in the same circles as you, then it's all like sort of self-selecting. It's like, well, all my friends still use PCs, but maybe every kid graduating school is doing, you know, like, for example, digital video. Like, if every kid graduating film school is shooting digital video and editing digital video, and you're like, well, all my friends are still shooting on film, so film's never going to die. You're being blind. You're missing it, right? But I think in this case, for the jobs that we're talking about, certainly programming, because I think we have a good view on that, not just for iOS and Mac programming, but just in all realms, that serious programming is still done in PC-style devices. Video editing, for the most part, is still done in PC-style devices, but you got to watch. You watch the kids. Watch the kids coming into film school. Are they are they editing their film school project on an iPad or on a Surface Studio or on anything like that? You know, that's sort of like the leading indicator, and that's the thing to watch for. I think right now the answer is that PC-style computers are still the thing to do. My big fear is that Apple decides that it's not worth them being in the business. I don't particularly have a fear that in the near future the PC style of computing is going to go away. I have a fear that the Apple personal computer, meaning the Mac, is going to go away because Apple doesn't care about it or neglects it to the point. And that's the worst case scenario, where you still have to use a PC, but you no longer get to choose the Mac because it's, you know, it's no longer any good for you.
That's when I switched to Linux.
God help us all. Quick side note about that, though, John. I had some coworkers at the last gig that did use Surface tablets to do their work, like to write code, to do their work, to do that was their computer. There were only a couple of them, and I think by and large they kind of regretted their decision, but in that sense, it is happening. That is a thing that happens from time to time.
Well, I would call that. I keep putting the Surface into it, but I'm thinking more of like using the touch interface to the Surface device, even more of the Surface Studio, where you are touching the screen. In many respects, the Surface Books and all that stuff, they're just a convertible laptop. Like it's muddled by the fact that Windows is this unified platform. But yeah, I have people at work who do programming stuff on Surfaces too. But it's just a laptop at that point. It's like a weird laptop with a bendy hinge. And it's running Windows, and they're running terminal stuff, and they have a keyboard, and they have a trackpad pointing device, and they also have a pen, and it can kind of be a tablet, but essentially they're using a laptop. Like they have Windows with title bars and scroll bars. Like it's confusing because of the way Microsoft has done its unified OS strategy, but I would still totally classify those as PC style because it is very distinct from the iOS style. Even when I see my daughter, she's got like a keyboard, Logitech keyboard thing for her iPad. Even when she does, you know, form of laptop with her, you know, that's Wonder Twins for you. You guys missed that show. Anyway, when she makes a little laptop out of her iPad and her keyboard, it's still not a laptop. Yes, it looks like one. Yes, there's a kind of a vertical-ish screen and a horizontal-ish keyboard, but there's no pointer on her screen. She's not using a trackpad. There are no windows. There are no scroll bars and scroll thumbs. There's no menu bar along the top of it. It is not a PC computing experience. She's not, you know, like, it's, yeah. We live in a strange time. We live in a strange transitional time, but some things defy categorization, but I think the salient points, like, what makes it a PC and what makes it a PC style computing environment are pretty clear. For me, obviously, it's all about Windows because what the hell? Imagine if the 28-inch Surface Studio did not have Windows. Like everything was full screen or split screen like it does on the iPad. We would say this is the biggest waste of a 28-inch screen in the world. Unless you're only ever in one app doing Lightroom all the time, then fine. But for a general purpose computing device, getting back to Marco's idea that you can do more than one thing at a time, a general purpose computing device that can only show apps in full screen on a 20-inch display is just a very wrong-headed idea. And I would say that's not PC computing. That's more like iOS.
Here's a question. Where in what product is Apple really like stepping on the gas and really firing on all cylinders?
AirPods. I know it's not a valid answer in this context, but I cannot stop talking about how much I love my AirPods.
I would say the iPhone. I mean, I think the last show I recently listened to it, so it's fresh in my mind. And Marco said, like, oh, the new iPhone 7, like, internally, the changes aren't that big. Like, look at the graphs, man. Like, every part of this that can be better, computing wise and capacity wise, is better by leaps and bounds, by like 90s era PC leaps and bounds. Like, it's not the CPU is not just a little bit faster. The GPU is not just a little bit faster. The flash capacity is like the max is, you know, isn't it double? Like, you can only get 128 last year. Now you can get 256s. It's fantastically better internal. You know, the only thing that's not, you know, better about it, but like, oh, they're not standing the gas, it's like, oh, the case is the same shape. And even there, they did, you know, they changed the Surface in such a way that Marco, you know, was saying is his favorite product of last year because it made such a difference in day-to-day use. So I still think iPhone is, you know, pedal to the metal, and AirPods are part of that, are part of their weird headphone thing, which, by the way, has bitten me. I don't have a USB-C laptop, but I've been bitten by the headphones thing like five times recently. where I thought I had everything I needed and was going to plug a headphone in and realized, right, even on the plane coming back, I brought the adapter for me to use my noise-canceling headphones, but then my daughter wanted to use some headphones too and plug in. It's like, oh, well, I only have one adapter. Like, you always think you have everything you need, but here, just use... Oh, never mind. Or gone on a car trip, and, you know, before... Yeah, and we're going to plug... In my wife's old car, she just had aux in with like a headphone port, and I brought my iPod with me, or my phone with me, and we can listen to like the podcast that I'm in the middle of, and we get in the car and start driving away, and I grab the little aux cord from the center console and pick it up and go, no. There's no place I can plug that into my phone. And of course, I'm not carrying the adapter around with me. So yeah, the struggle is real, as they say.
We are sponsored this week by Casper, an obsessively engineered mattress at a shockingly fair price. Go to casper.com/ATP and use code ATP for $50 towards your mattress. Casper created one perfect mattress sold directly to consumers, eliminating commission-driven inflated prices. The award-winning Casper mattress was developed in-house with a sleek design and is delivered in a remarkably small box. You can get it up narrow stairs if you need to. And also, in addition to the mattress, Casper also now offers an adaptive pillow and soft, breathable sheets. The mattress industry has forced consumers into paying notoriously high markups. Casper revolutionizes the industry by cutting the cost of dealing with resellers and passing that savings directly on to you. The in-house team of engineers spent thousands of hours developing the Casper mattress. It contains supportive memory foams for a sleep surface with just the right sink and just the right bounce. And its breathable design sleeps cool to help you regulate your temperature throughout the night. And also, Casper has made buying mattresses online easy and completely risk-free. I mean, it sounds crazy, a mattress online, but they offer free delivery and free returns within a 100-night home trial period. So here's how this works. You can just buy the mattress. Just take the risk. Because if you don't love it within 100 nights, just call them up and they will arrange a pickup at your house and give you a full refund. No questions asked. They understand the importance of truly sleeping on a mattress before you commit. Because you're going to be spending a third of your life on it. We've heard from friends and listeners who all have great things to say about Casper mattresses. And Time Magazine named it one of the best inventions of 2015. So check it out today. Get your Casper mattress. Try it for 100 nights in your home, risk-free. Free delivery, free returns with home pickup. Go to casper.com/ATP to see for yourself. casper.com/ATP and use code ATP for $50 towards your mattress. Terms and conditions do apply. Thank you very much to Casper for sponsoring our show.
All right, final bit of follow-up, speaking of cars. So,
follow-up.
Yeah, we're almost done. Well, this is one of those episodes where follow-up isn't exactly follow-up, which is probably most episodes. Anyway, Sam Abuelsamid, who is a co-host of the Wheel Bearings podcast, which if you ever wanted neutral but with people who actually knew what they were talking about, you should look up Wheel Bearings. It's pretty good. Anyway, he writes in to say the 2016-2017 model year Accords do indeed support both CarPlay and Android Auto, as do most new Hondas. The only Hondas that are still waiting for Android Auto and CarPlay update are the Fit and the HR-V. I'm not sure what that is. I know the CR-V, but not the HR-V.
You don't know what the HR-V is? Be glad it's terrible, but...
Yeah. Anyway, the 2018 Odyssey is debuting in a couple of weeks at the Detroit Auto Show. So... that makes me think that Tina's car does indeed have CarPlay, does it not?
So here's the question. I've never used CarPlay. I've seen pictures of it online, and I think I've even seen like screenshots of like Marco's CarPlay stuff, and I've seen Marco's disembodied CarPlay testing whatchamacallit thing, right? But I don't know how CarPlay works. Do I have to download an app onto my phone called CarPlay?
No.
So you think if I just plug a phone into my wife's car with a wire, because we don't have the wireless version, that something will happen on the screen to indicate you are in CarPlay now?
Apparently, if you just plug it in, there'll be one of those alerts, like a computer where it says, do you trust this car or something like that? And then magic happens. Now, I've not witnessed this myself. This is just real-time follow-up, but that's what I'm being told.
Do I trust this car?
Yeah. Last time Tina was saying that it was only on certain trim levels. Bottom line is, this is like the Schrodinger's cat of CarPlay support. Until I actually try it, her car both has CarPlay support and doesn't have CarPlay support. But seriously, it had not occurred to me to think, like, do I have to download an app? And once I download the app, do I do a thing? Or is it just plugging it in? And I think basically we've never actually plugged any of our iPhones into her car because it's all been Bluetooth. So it could be that, that's totally right. And as soon as I plug it in.
Oh, John, how do you not know this already? That would be the first thing I tried.
I've driven that car onto and off of the driveway like twice. That's how far I've driven that car.
Why don't you just go outside right now and give it a shot? I'm kind of not kidding. I'm really not kidding. Why don't you just go give it a... It won't take too long. It'll take just a minute.
All right. I'll be back. Hang on.
So literally as I'm saying this, Tina is sending me a text saying that it is not a thing. Hold on.
I'm looking up the HRV. It's kind of, it looks basically like the Honda X1.
Oh, okay. Oh, standard on Accord EX, EXL, and Touring.
Right, but trim. I think she doesn't have the EX, so I think it's optional for her trim. Is it just not there, or was it optional? That's what we don't know.
That I don't know. What is it? Honda USA? I hate that whenever you go to like Honda or Audi or whatever, it's the corporate. This is the most American thing I think I've ever said. But why does it not go? Why does it not go directly to America?
It's just like in the country list drop downs. Why are we not the first sign listed? Like I know alphabetically
exactly.
We're not.
This is barbaric.
Do I really have to scroll through? Like, how likely is it that I'm actually from like you know any of these other places? Like just put the U.S. on top for all the stupid arrogant Americans, and then put everything else below it.
I am fully behind this. Tina's saying there was no option. It's she does not have an EX. It's sport special. It was not an option. There's basically no options, period, anyway.
Well, I guess John went outside in the cold in the winter for no reason. Oh, well. I'm sure he won't be mad.
I'm now getting yelled at by Tina that nobody wants to believe her. I did believe you, Tina.
We just wanted to send John outside.
Well, that too. This is basically every conversation I've had with Aaron ever. Aaron tells me this is not a thing or this is a thing. No, you've got to be wrong. Oh, it turns out you're right. It's every conversation I've ever had with Aaron.
Yeah, I believe we have words for this. One of the more charitable ones would probably be mansplaining.
Oh, the magic of technology.
Hi, John.
Here's what happened. So I go to the car and I get all my stuff and my cables and everything and I plug, you know, get the car turned on. I plug the thing in. I wait to see something pop up on my phone screen. Nothing ever pops up. Wait a couple seconds and I hear you two talking about what I'm doing right now. Like talking about going through the car phone configurator, the Honda website and stuff like that.
Because Tina's phone popped on the
right,
Bluetooth.
So Tina, my wife is listening to the phone upstairs on Bluetooth, and the car is paired with her phone. And so for a second, I'm like, what in the world is going on?
That is so amazing. Awesome.
Ah, the magic of Bluetooth. Anyway, my result of this short experiment was that plugging in the phone does nothing. I was not prompted to do anything. I couldn't find anything in any of the menus that mentioned CarPlay or anything about CarPlay. I could connect my phone by Bluetooth, but that's not how CarPlay works. It's not a Bluetooth audio thing. So inconclusive results, but at the very least, merely plugging my phone in did nothing.
While you were gone, I'm pretty sure we found out that your wife was right the whole time and you didn't even need to go outside.
See, that's there you go. Thanks, Sam, guy on the car podcast who knows something supposedly.
Your wife knows better.
Oh, I'm sure we'll get some feedback on this one.
Amazingly, sometimes we don't know what we're talking about.
Really?
And this is why we used to do a car show, kids. People love when you don't know what you're talking about and you do a car podcast. People really like that.
They think it's the best.
I reject this characterization. I know a lot about cars. I know a lot about what I was talking about. You two keep saying that about yourselves, but I reject that.
Oh, God. This episode is making is turning to be quite good.
I love how we just have like no structure this week. Like,
we did follow up. All those items were legit follow up.
Mm.
One of them was even homework, and man, they went long. Sometimes follow-up goes long, but you know that tends to happen after lots of stuff builds up if we haven't recorded for a while. The problematic part we have here is as we transition to topics, go look what's lurking there.
Wait, let's look at the notes.
The very first item, who put that in there? It's got to be Casey. Did you put that in there?
Yes. I don't think I want to talk about it though.
Right. It's just like, it's the same thing we've been talking about for the past month on the show. I don't feel like, I read parts of that article.
It's gone.
But
it's done.
Before, yeah, I know you deleted it, but.
Oh, God, here we
go. Is there anything in that article that is not something that we've already talked about? That's my only question.
Yeah, probably not. So the article in question, hopefully we'll cut this from the show, but the article in question
we're talking
is,
about it.
Yeah, Chuck von Rossbach, I've probably pronounced that wrong. I apologize. But anyway, his Apple 2016 year in review. which TLDR, some things suck, some things don't, but
it's a great post. You
know, it is.
Yeah. Good. I mean, it's good. It's totally a good, you know, he's expressing in a much more succinct way, his position on the same issues.
Succinct
that
is not necessarily the word I would use. It's a
well,
lot of
it's too. More succinct than like hours and hours of audio, but like, you know, we're all Mac fans and we're all kind of experiencing some dissatisfaction with the treatment of the Mac, and we've talked about it at length, and this was his take on it, and it was good, and it was articulate, and it was an expression of his opinion and his desires and his hopes and dreams, and it was a good post. But for the purposes of discussion on the show, I'm wondering if it is bringing any new angle that we haven't already given our opinions on umpteen times.
Yeah, and since we'll be asked about it, God, who was it that wrote this? Hold on 1 second.
Chris Adamson?
Chris Adamson's post. Yeah.
Also very good, although I honestly, I don't know if the Mac Pro was the best choice there, but we're seeing now from a lot of people saying similar things. This is not a coincidence. This is not an accident. This is not a trend or people being wrong. This is like legitimately Apple is causing concern in many of its customers and many of its best, biggest fans and longest time customers. And so, you know, I think if I can summarize in a very quick way, or at least like try to put a cap on this for now, 2017 is going to be a very important year for Apple to prove a lot of big things to the market and to its customers. Right now, there's a lot of things where the answer from Apple so far is either silence or like just wait, you know, like wait till you see what we have next or something like that. 2017, a lot of this stuff is coming due. You know, like if 2017 passes through the whole year and there isn't like a major new iPhone design and there isn't some answer to the Mac Pro and there isn't maybe better quarterly earnings, these are some pretty big things. There have been bad signs on these fronts for the last year or so, but everyone's like, oh, next year or soon, or this is going to be out soon, or this is going to be fixed soon, or the next iPhone's going to be great, or those quarterly earnings were an anomaly. All those promises are going to be due this year. And we, you know, a year from now, when we're presumably still having this podcast and still doing follow-up, we will see, were all of our concerns unfounded? How well are all these complaints going to age? You know, are we all wrong? Is Apple about to release over the course of the next year amazing things that are going to blow our minds, and we're going to feel good about the Mac again, and we're going to feel good about Apple's prospects again, and we're going to feel good about the iPhone design again, all this stuff, and their numbers are going to go up and everyone on the market's going to be happy? Like, is that really going to happen this year? It might. We don't know yet. We'll find out. And I really hope things go better, because frankly, if they don't, I'm going to have to find other stuff to talk about, because I'm tired of being sad all the time about all the stuff I love.
Wargrove in the chat room had a good turn of phrase, which I'm going to slightly improve. 2017, year of macOS on the desktop.
Nice.
Oh,
pretty good, huh?
Nice.
Ooh.
So I know Marco wanted to put a capper on this, but unfortunately the next item in the topic list is the one tiny sliver of new angle on this, yes, very old and tired topic that happened to occur to me and that I tweeted earlier today. It was in response to Michael Size. He's had a series of articles on this whole same thing, like so many other Mac bloggers, and he's an old-time Mac user, and he's feeling all the same things. And one of his posts was on finding an alternative to what he calls Mac OS X. But he's not on board with the new naming, I guess. And he links to Wesley Moore's post about this, about, you know, trying to find, I'm looking into different Linux distributions and stuff. Like, people are looking for alternatives for Mac OS X. They're not looking for an escape hatch, but like at the very least trying to see what else is out there. Like, before I was happy using the Mac and I wasn't really looking at alternatives, but now I'm starting to consider, like, hey, what else is out there? How's Windows doing? You know, is Linux any good? Let me try a few different distributions, stuff like that. And then Gruber also talked about it. Anyway, so this Michael Sy post, what I tweeted, I used the little quote tweet feature, which I actually am starting to like because it gives me room to actually write something while also including their tweet.
Welcome to like 2 years ago, John.
I know. I mean, my client has supported it. The iOS version of Twitter, it's great. It's totally up to date. But I'm still, my habits are based on the old ways.
Talk about like not knowing when to move on.
No, like, I use it, but like my normal Twitter way would be to like, I write a tweet and then paste the last 20 characters be the shortened URL, right? But by quoting, you get some characters back. Anyway, what I tweeted was, the last time Mac users were seriously passing around articles like this, articles like the one about finding alternatives, was during the transition from macOS to macOS 10. And as I tweeted to someone else who had replied, someone replied, oh, I can't wait for the million replies that are going to say, and now it's the transition from macOS to iOS, ha ha ha, which, yes, there were many of those replies. But, you know, my commentary on the follow-up to this was analysis intentionally omitted. A, because it's Twitter and you don't have room to do that. And B, I like to just let this tweet lie because it is like a Rorschach test. You know, the last time I saw articles about this was the transition from macOS to macOS 10. Half the people are going to see that and say, yeah, and weren't those dummies wrong? Because macOS 10 was awesome and all the people clinging to macOS were a bunch of chumps. And the other half of the people are going to say, yeah, that's around the last time the Mac almost died and we came through it by the skin of our teeth, by, you know, struggling mightily to get this next-based OS up into shipshape so that it's satisfying to Mac users. And then yet another group of people are going to say, yes, but a lot of people actually did leave the Mac then. It's just that they were replaced by Unix nerds and it all evened out or actually was a net win. And so many different views on how the macOS 10 transition went. You know, I'm fairly intimately familiar with the macOS 10 transition, so I know what I think about it. But so many different people have different ideas of like what it was like. You guys didn't experience this. You didn't experience the incredible turmoil. Much worse than the current turmoil we're facing. Much, much, much worse of practically a dying company. Certainly a dying OS. Like this is, you know, in your parlance, the Windows 95. You know, no memory protection, no preemptive multitasking. Like trying to get from that world into a modern OS while trying to preserve something, anything that was good about the Mac. It totally felt like Apple as a company could be dying, which is not a thing that we are currently worried about right now at all, right? And certainly that the Mac could be dying along with the company, because even if they survive, what comes out the other side of this thing will not be a Mac. It'll be some stupid Unix thing with a terminal that won't be a Mac at all, and everything is terrible. In the end, you know, I think we successfully navigated that transition, but all of the participants, all of the players were there. There wasn't that much podcasting going on, but I can tell you that there were many, many people who were from the old school Mac world complaining, just like we've been complaining on this podcast, through every channel available to them. Again, Twitter didn't exist either, but like Usenet, lots of arguing on Usenet. I remember arguing with some person named Guy English, which just totally sounds like a made-up name, on Usenet, yeah, about the merits of classic macOS versus Next. I don't know who that guy was. On the nascent web and on our blogs and in person and in Mac user groups and the pages of magazines and letters to editors about how the Mac was going. And the reason I reference that is not because I think we're in the same situation again. I think that was a way more dire situation, which gives me some comfort because it's like I came through that and we're nowhere near as bad as that is. But just to say that no one was seriously circulating, check out these alternatives to Mac OS X in the circles among diehard Mac users. Obviously, there's always, you know, articles about like, hey, if you're thinking of using this, look at this alternative, blah, blah, blah. But within our sort of blogging and tweeting circles of all these people who have been using Macs for years and love it, I hadn't seen an article like this in ages, let alone a series of them. To find one, I have to go back to the last time our little community was in turmoil, and that was when people were like, oh, if they're going to do this to the Mac, I might as well use Windows, or I might as well try Linux, or I'm going to leave the Mac and go to, you know, there was, you know, no one said they're going to leave the Mac and go to Palm OS, because that wasn't, you know, anyway. It gives me some historical perspective, but it also highlights the fact that even though the current situation is not as bad as it was then, it is at least of the same type that these kinds of articles are in circulation and are of interest to everybody, even if you don't feel that way, even if you just want to read it so you can sneer at the people who are, you know, claiming that the sky is falling or whatever. The fact is the articles are being passed around and people are reading them and people are thinking about it, and that hasn't happened in a long time. How long ago was the macOS 10 transition? 2001-ish? So we had a good 15 years of peace, and now now we're going to have a little bit of, if not war, then maybe at least famine and pestilence.
Wow.
We are sponsored tonight by Squarespace. Go to squarespace.com to start your own free trial site today and use code ATP to get 10% off your first purchase when you sign up. Squarespace, make your next move. So Squarespace is this amazing web hosting platform. You go there to create a site for yourself or for other people if they're having you make a site for them. And it is so incredibly easy. They have easy-to-use tools. Everything can be drag and drop. What you see is what you get. Live previews everywhere. It's kind of, when you do it, if you know anything about web programming, when you use Squarespace's control panel, it kind of blows your mind that this is even possible. And any web programmers will know, like, wow, this is, they put a lot of work into this. And all of that was in service of you, the person making the website, so that you don't have to do any of that stuff. It's so good that it's really not worth making your website anywhere else for almost anybody. Like, unless you have some really narrow, specialized need, even then you could probably have Squarespace accommodate it somehow. Like, it's really, really impressive what you can do on Squarespace. And it's so incredibly easy, regardless of your skill level, whether you're a novice, whether you're a programmer, it doesn't even matter. You can use Squarespace and it can save you tons of time and hassle and make a professional looking site. Because they have great designers working with them to make these templates and to give you lots of great options to customize it to make it your own. So check it out today at squarespace.com. If you need to make a website for yourself or someone else, doesn't matter. Start it there at Squarespace. Because first of all, if you're making it for somebody else, Squarespace becomes their support person after you've made it for them. So, and you know what? They can probably make it themselves once you direct them there. So you can cut yourself out of the loop completely and get back to your life. If you're making a site for yourself, why waste time doing it any other way? Do it on Squarespace. You'll thank me later. Give it a shot. Squarespace.com. When you decide to sign up, make sure to use offer code ATP to get 10% off your first purchase. Make your next move with a beautiful website from Squarespace.
Since clearly the Mac is doomed and the future is not even iOS, it's voice, tell us about your Google Home.
My Google Home. Yeah, so I got a Google Home as a gift for my wife / gift for the family. It's complicated by the fact that our photos are, you know, I signed up for Google Photos using my 1 terabyte of Google.
Wait, can we back up for a second?
Yeah.
I heard from your wife that you got this Google Home as a gift.
I'm getting to that.
As a gift to her, uh-huh. And then paired it to your phone?
I'm about to. And it's not paired to the phone. I'm about to explain this. So,
did it say Homer on it? Is that?
Yeah. It's obviously for, you know, for the whole family, because it just sits in a room. It's not like one of us has it on their desk or something, right? But one of the things that it can do for you is you can ask it to, like, display your photos on your TV. So show me pictures of whoever on my Chromecast, and it will do that. I don't have a Chromecast yet, but I plan to get one. They're like $30 or whatever. It's not a big deal. And I do have HDMI ports available on the side of my TV, so I'm going to do that. But all of our Google Photos are associated with my Google account, not hers. Even though she has the iPhone, the photo library on her 5K iMac under her account, so she owns that. But I mean, and this is actually a feature. I like the fact that we can do this. I had 1 terabyte of Google storage that I use for other things. And so when it came time to look into Google Photos, I said, I can run the Google Photos thing on your account on your 5K iMac, but use it to upload all of your photos from the family photo library up to my Google account storage, because I'm the one with 1 terabyte of storage. And so I have all the Google Photos, and you can only associate the Google Home with one Google account ID. It's the first thing I searched by Googling. Because I saw how you could set it up, like, okay, now how do I add another account? Because, you know, in all the Google web properties, you can be signed into multiple accounts and switch among them and have, you know, like, I thought, surely that's a thing. But I immediately found out that Google Home currently is limited to being connected to one Google account. So it is connected to my Google account. And the reason it's connected to my Google account is because I'm the one with all the photos. And that's one of the few things that this thing can do for me. So that's limitation number one about this. Limitation number two is, I mean, it's a big number two. We'll link in the show notes this article Dan Morin wrote about these devices, because he's been an avid Amazon.
I look forward to the summary of this, like on like the book jacket, like John Siracusa calls Google Home ... a big number two.
Yeah. Well, the number two thing is that basically, like, Amazon Echo has a big lead and it does way more stuff, right? It just does, especially in terms of home automation and those other things. Like, it's been out longer. It has more integrations. And so if you're looking for something you can take out of the box and hook up a bunch of 50 different things to and make your own actions, like, this is not that thing. Someone asked me on Twitter if you had to do it over again, would you still buy the Google Home? And I'm like, how do you even know I have a Google Home? And what are you talking about doing it over again? I just got the Google Home. Like, I don't know. But the reason I got it, and I think we talked about this before when I said I was interested to get it. The reason I got it is because I believe in the promise. I believe in the promise of Google Home as a product. The actuality of Google Home as a product is that it's nicer looking than the Echo. In some ways, it's better in terms of, I think maybe the speaker is a little bit better and it's smaller and, it's a little bit more polished, I think. But I'm totally buying it because I believe that Google will eventually be better at all the things that I care about, which is understanding what I'm saying and finding me useful information and answers. And I do use Google Calendar. We all use Google Calendar. I use Google for my email. We have all our photos on Google. In theory, this has access to more of our stuff than the Amazon Echo would. And I subscribe to Google Play because I subscribe to Google Play family thing to get YouTube Red or whatever. So I can say things like, I hate OK Google, but that's what it is instead of Alexa. I wish you could make that configurable. But I could say, OK Google, play some Christmas music. And guess what? It plays Christmas music because it has access to, their streaming music service. Whereas if you ask the Amazon Echo to do the same thing, you can set something up to do it, or you can try to get it to play audio on another Bluetooth connected device and it'll play the audio that's on that device or whatever. But anyway, so far, mostly the children have been asking it to say things in foreign languages and do unit conversions. I did use it to set timers. But it is really limited. Like one of the very first things I asked it to do was, remind me in 2 hours to check on the roast. This was like on Christmas Day. Right. And it said, I can't set up a reminder for you. Sorry about that. Something like that. I'm like, you can't set up reminders. Like you don't need to do, this doesn't need to be a network integration. Just do it. Right. It can do timers, set a timer for 2 hours for the roast. Okay, I've set a timer for 2 hours for the roast, right? But remind me in 2 hours. It knows that I want a reminder, but I guess it classifies them in the same way that Apple classifies reminders versus timers, and it has no way to create a reminder in the world of Google yet, right? So again, I Googled this and sit on a million people saying, yes, it can't set reminders yet. Maybe it will be able to in the future. So I really hope that they get cranking on the integrations and the functionality. I am very impressed with its ability to understand my children's poor diction as they yell over each other to try to get it to do things, right? I'm impressed with its ability to understand me talking from other rooms and mumbling and how responsive it is to asking it to set timers. It takes me longer to figure out when I can start talking to Siri than it does to complete the action on the Google Home, right? Because that is an internal frustration. I have the fanciest, fastest iPhone, and half the time I'm like, is it okay for me to talk? Do I have to wait for the ba-boop? And then like I start talking, then it goes ba-boop, and then it doesn't understand me, and I can't reset it, and then I have to start all over. And I just want to be able to talk into the air. And you mentioned, Casey, before Siri in the Mac. This is, I think, one of the things that both the Amazon Echo and the Google Home do so much better than Siri on the Mac. If Siri on the Mac really wants to be worth a damn, it should be like those two devices where I can just say, okay, Mac, what's the weather like tomorrow? No preamble, no pressing a key, no making sure the Mac is ready before I talk. Just freaking say it. Because if this little tiny $100 cylinder can do it, this huge multi-thousand-dollar computer should be able to do that too. Let alone the fact that there's no Hey Siri. It's like, oh, you can hook up this app script to make it so it recognizes when you say Hey. No. Like, if the cylinders can do it, a Mac has to be able to do it too. Because as Marco well knows, that is the killer feature. To be able to just rattle it off in the air with no setup and no preamble and no making sure everybody is ready, and it just friggin' does it. And that's awesome, right? I think the most important feature of all these cylinders is really good microphones that can understand you from far away with background noise and incredible responsiveness. And iPhones don't have that, and Macs don't have that, and it's a damn shame. So, anyway, Google Home, it shows promise. For the things that it can do, it's very responsive. I intentionally bought it because I believe in the promise of Google doing this type of stuff really well. And the things that it does do really well. You can phrase your, like Google Search, you can phrase your unit conversions or questions about the weather or follow-up questions in a fairly natural way, and it pretty much nails it. It just needs more features, so I'm patiently waiting for them to appear.
Yeah, I gotta say, I have yet to see the Google Home, but having had now quite a bit of experience with the Amazon Echo, these like home cylinders with voice stuff that connect to simple things like timers and weather and music services and home automation, this is a real deal. This category is really great. It's really fun, And there is this pretty significant, like, you know, land grab going on right now, mostly being won by Amazon. I am honestly kind of concerned that Apple's not playing in this space yet. And I've, you know, we've heard rumblings that they're working on it. I really hope they get here soon, because this is the time to get into this business. So over Christmas, we got my in-laws an Echo. It was kind of funny. Like, for the last, you know, 5 or 6 Christmases, we've gotten people various Apple things, you know, like Apple TVs here and there, and occasionally iPads for, like, big gifts sometimes. This year, nobody got anything by Apple. Like, this year was, Apple had nothing to do with our holiday fun this year. They were just, you know, we were all, like, using iPhones, basically, but, like, there was nothing. There was no, like, new stuff from Apple this year for us. And granted, I know the AirPods are a big deal for a lot of people, but that wasn't for our holiday season. Anyway, all the fun was playing with the Echo, and these, you know, and all, like, the home automation. Like, I got a handful of, like, the Belkin Wemo outlets and everything that you could switch with them, and it's just like, this stuff. This is where all the action's happening right now, in, like, cool, fun, new technology. And yeah, it isn't like, you know, a massive business. There's not a lot of profit to be made here. I mean, Amazon's already selling the Echo for under $200, and the Dots are like $40. And what's the Google Home, like, 150 or something? What?
I got it on sale. It was one of the reasons I bought it. I got it for like 110 or 120.
Yeah. So, like, you know, it's obviously going to be like a low margin business for, you know, probably forever. And that's going to be difficult for Apple, because I can't see Apple coming in at, you know, under 250 probably. You know, I mean, look, the Apple TV is, you know, in a similar boat where, like, all the competitors are really cheap, and Apple TV is still very expensive for, you know, compared to them. So anyway, you know, I worry about Apple in this business, because, like, it's so cool. It's so much fun. These devices are really, really awesome. But in order to be good, like they require two things Apple's not very good at: service consistency and integrations with a whole bunch of other stuff. I don't say that as a joke. Like, you know, Siri, for all of its benefits and faults, one thing it really isn't. Even people who love Siri, I think they would usually agree, one thing it really isn't is consistent. And, you know, like, the Echo is so incredibly rock solid. So anyway, between Google and Amazon, I really haven't read a single review of the Google Home that makes me think anybody should buy it over the Echo. All the reviews seem to say, like, yeah, it's kind of the same thing, but worse. Like, what am I missing here?
I mean, it is. I feel like it is better at all the same things that Google is good at. That you can type things into a Google search box in lots of different ways, and it more or less figures out what you mean. Like, in the same way that, you know, the difference between, we know when Google does that thing where it puts, like, it's like, here are a bunch of search results and here are a bunch of ads, but by the way, I'm pretty sure I know what you're getting at, and here's a box at the top that shows, like, exactly what you're interested in, like the score of a game or, like, the answer to the trivia question you were asking or whatever, before it even gets to the search results. That type of stuff is more or less exposed in a spoken way, as opposed to, like, you know, like, what was it, when Dan Morin in his review was talking about doing the language translation. The Echo, or Alexa rather, can do that as well, but it displays the results on your phone in the iOS app. It doesn't speak them back to you. So it's like, it's basically all the things that Google is good at. If you're interested in controlling stuff in your home, Echo has way more integrations. If you're interested in buying things, like, forget it. That's Amazon's bread and butter. You want to buy things by talking, Amazon's got you covered. I don't even know if you can do that at all in Google.
Tell you what, by the way, that sounds like a stupid thing until you do it.
I'm sure you love it.
Because, you know, once you've given in to the Amazon way of life and you start ordering, like, everything from Amazon, you can do things like, say, name of thing, reorder a fridge filter. And it will go through your order history, and it will query it for the phrase fridge filter, and it'll say, do you want me to add this thing? You know, it'll read out the name, and it'll say, here's how much it costs, and here's, you know, it has 4-star reviews or whatever else, and it'll say, do you want to buy it now? And you can, you know, you can add it to your cart and just do it later. You can add it to your shopping list, or you can just have it say yes and place the order right then. You can literally get rid of your, like, I ran out of this thing, or I need another one of these things. You can eliminate those problems, like, without ever touching a computer. Like, oh, my fridge filter needs to be replaced. All right, get a new fridge filter. 2 days later, it just shows up. It's kind of amazing. I also, before we got this, thought that was a ridiculous concept. But once you do it, like, once, and you kind of break the, like, break the seal almost, or like you break hearts. Like, once you do it once, you're just like, oh my God, this is kind of awesome. Why have I not been doing this?
And I think we're kind of in an Apple-Google situation, like in the early days of the iPhone, where it was like, oh, we have this nice sort of symbiosis where Apple's going to do this awesome hardware in the OS, and Google will do the cloud services, like the maps and stuff, and it's a marriage made in heaven, and then they split. It seems like they're already split, because there are things that Amazon does better, but there are also things that Google does better. It, like, basically, any kind of search or intelligence or figuring out what you mean, Amazon can do all those things mostly because they have integrations with Google or Google-like services, but they don't do them themselves. Whereas buying things, Amazon is totally like, it's all integrated with your Amazon account. It knows your order history. It can do all that stuff like that. You would want a home automation thing that can do all of these things, right? And the same way of like, I don't know, Amazon probably has this because they have every service under the sun, but Google has all my photos in it. Amazon doesn't have any of my photos. I can't ask the Echo to show photos of my son on the television, you know, show photos of my son from 2015 on my Chromecast. I can't ask Amazon to do that. I mean, I could maybe make a little skill or a program or a little app in there, a little thing that make it do, but Google's got my stuff. And in the same way, Apple, if they ever come out with one, Apple's got a lot of my stuff too. They've also got my photos, and you know, they have my reminders because I use reminders on my phone, and they have my iMessages, but they don't have my calendar because Google has that. And so, you know, in some respects, the best would be a cylinder that you talk to that doesn't have a horse in that race, but integrates with all of them, sort of the cylinder equivalent of the omnivorous box. But of course, that doesn't exist. So instead, we have to choose silos. The Apple silo has nothing except for a sort of cranky Siri that you can't really talk to. And by the way, if they ever did make a cylinder, can you imagine if they made it respond to Ahoy Telephone, which I'm not going to say? Every device in your home would go off, and then maybe the cylinder would bloop later. Like, they should just give these things different names or whatever.
Well, and this is like, it actually is not an easy problem to solve. When the Amazon set of products first came out, if you had more than one, which they're so cheap, and you kind of always want one nearby. So I think a lot of people have or will have more than one, which again puts a problem on Apple's strategy of probably a nicer, more expensive one. When you have more than one, like if both of them are within earshot when you say the trigger word, you know, originally they would just kind of both operate independently. Eventually, in a software update, which by the way, I never even had to know about, like they just update themselves and don't even tell you. They just update. It's amazing. But in a software update, eventually they added the thing where like you can give them both the same trigger word, and now like whichever one like heard you best will handle the command. And so, and you know, there, I believe. They're also wanting to work on things like multi-room audio, similar to what Sonos does. I think Google Home talked about something like that. Either they're doing it or they're going to do it. Like, this is actually, it's going to ramp up quickly into a category where like the minimum bar to entry is actually, you know, non-trivial. That's why I kind of like, for Apple's sake, if they're going to play in this business at all, I hope they get here soon, because there's a lot to do and the competitors are going to keep raising that bar. And Apple's just going to be playing catch up if they really don't get here very, very soon.
I feel like Amazon, even though they are the leader now, is at quite a disadvantage because both Google and Apple have more of people's stuff than Amazon. The only thing Amazon has for most people is their purchase history and their purchases, which is great for Amazon because if they're trying to find a way for you to order things by talking and make money, that's fine. But most people don't have all their family photos on there. Most people don't have big video collections up on Amazon. Most people don't have their calendars on Amazon or their, you know, reminders or their shopping list, which even though it has these features, like, in other words, to win, like you said, this, you have to have, it's an ecosystem play. And Apple has its ecosystem and Google has its, and you can argue about whose is better or whatever, but Amazon's is the least full featured of all of them. Like, and Google, you know, you have to actually integrate with them for you to win. Doesn't help that Google, like, oh, Google has a calendar. If I can't do anything with the calendar, which you can ask it about your day and stuff like that. Or Google has maps data and traffic data. Like, you need the integrations, but it's easier to make those integrations if Google actually gives a damn about this product, because that's Google's other weaknesses. Historically, they've been like, oh, we'll try this, but maybe we're not that interested, whatever, right? But it's easier for Google to do those integrations than it is for Amazon to get people to use Amazon for email, Amazon for calendars, Amazon for photo storage. Like, even if they offer these services, even if they make all these services, even if they make world-class versions of these services to match both Apple and Google's services, then you have to get people to switch to them. So there is a big disadvantage for them to ever be in the ballpark if this becomes an ecosystem-wide play. their ace in the hole is like, we don't have to have that ecosystem. We will try to be as omnivorous as possible and give people a way to make those integrations. So, hey, buy the Amazon Echo. If you have your reminders on Apple, we can integrate with them. If you have your calendar on Google, we can integrate with them. Like that's their out, but it's certainly easier for Apple and Google to integrate with their own stuff. It's just, you know, they're playing catch up. And like in that article, that we'll link in the show notes, that reviewing them, it's like, oh, Google, Amazon integrates with all of these. Amazon integrates with all these home automation devices, and Google just integrates with these three. But every single other one that was listed has announced support for Google Home, right? So it's not like Google is behind, but it's not like they're like Apple, where they do a single sign-on thing and then wait 6 months and say the same three pathetic companies are the only ones we got for single sign-on. Oops. Like everybody has announced for Google Home.
That doesn't mean anything. A lot of people announced for HomeKit too.
I know, but it's a question of whether Google follows through on that. And you know, Google actually released a product. They announced a product, and they released it, and it works, which is way more than Apple has done. So Apple is clearly in last place, and I have some faith that Google Home will have a more illustrious career and life than did all the other, like Google TV and weird stuff. And just think about the Chromecast, which seemed like this little turdy thing that had no future. But tons of people have Chromecasts and love them. And even though it's a very small, simple thing, now you get Chromecast and Google Home. Now you have two pieces, and they kind of fit together. And that Chromecast that was already valuable suddenly becomes more valuable because you have Google Home. This is like ecosystem 101. So I do have some faith that Google understands that they can be and are a player here, while Apple snoozes and while Amazon takes all of Marco's money every time he speaks.
$14 at a time for a fridge filter.
Yeah, and the option, by the way, the Dan Morin option is, these things are like 100 and something bucks. There's no reason you can't have both of them. They don't take up that much room. Dan Morin's got two of them in his house. I think he's got like three of them in his house. There's no reason you can't have all of them and say, Alexa, buy me toilet paper and Google translate this phrase for me, or Google what's on my calendar today, right? It's confusing to talking to multiple assistants, but it's not that bad. Like, it's not like you're making a $3,000 investment in a computing platform. You're just buying a little cylinder and plugging it into the wall somewhere. So I'm actually considering that as well, to get both of them, because they don't conflict. It's fine.
How much the ecosystem matters to which one succeeds or fails, or which ones succeed or fail, I think also depends on what people want these cylinders to do. Like, what is the role this is playing for you? And, you know, like your thing about, like, you asked the Google thing to show you pictures from your Google photo stream of something on your TV. I would never do that. You were doing that. And so, you know, like, obviously, like, people are going to have different needs for this kind of thing. But, you know, I think certain roles are going to come out ahead. Like, one of the things, like, there was a rumor that came out a couple of weeks ago about how, like, maybe the next Echo might be like a tablet kind of thing that's really made to be a kitchen appliance, really, like, because they've found that so many people put the Echo in their kitchens. And it turns out people really like using it in the kitchen while cooking. So, you know, it'd be nice to maybe have something like, you know, a screen showing your timers, because timers are a really popular thing, as opposed to just like, you know, some kind of, you know, audio thing we have now, or a screen to show like a recipe that you're cooking or whatever else. So, you know, Amazon is finding their uses in the kitchen. Google might find their uses in the living room. Each one could find their own audience, or it might turn out that the things that Google is optimizing for, people actually just want to use their phones to do those things. And no one's really going to want their cylinders to do that. And so Google might be making a bad bet on that. And maybe people really want just a kitchen cylinder that plays music out of these things most of the time. You know, maybe Amazon will win there. Who knows? Like, I don't think it's a safe assumption to say that the ecosystems that each of these companies have now are a sure thing to guarantee their success in this new area, because we might find with this new area that people will use it differently than what we initially expect.
Yeah, but like I was saying, it's a question of whether it's easier to add integrations or whether it's easier to add those ecosystems, because like having ownership of people's calendars and their messages and their purchases, like those are things like purchases, for example, there's no way Apple and Google can get that. They can't like, oh, we're going to start a competing retail business, so we'll have a list of people's purchases too. Nope, you won't. And in the same way, Amazon can't say, we're going to start an email service and it's going to be as big as Gmail. Nope, it won't. And we're going to have a calendaring service and it'll be as integrated into the iPhone as Apple's calendar or with Android as Google's. You won't. Like, so the lines are kind of drawn along there. And those things are not esoteric. Like photos, calendar, email address, messages, purchases, those are fundamental Those are fundamentally owned. It's kind of like they have those squares on the Monopoly board, right? And they're not going away. It's just a question of how they're going to be divvied up between them. And the extras about the integrations, like with the Chromecast, the example I gave of putting photos on my TV, this is the thing I do now, but I do it the long, annoying manual way, which is always annoying. I use Apple TV to do it. I pull up the photo library. Half of the thumbnails don't show up. It's a terrible experience, but like it's a thing I want to do. And relatives are over. Let's look at pictures. I have them usually sorted into albums or smart albums or something like that. Let me see the picture of my wife's trip, Mediterranean cruise. I have all those set up. I already have the album. Apple TV, because I use my photos and Apple things, has that stuff, and I just want to see them. And I have to use that terrible remote and use a bunch of applications to, you know, make sure her computer is on and awake and blah, blah, blah. Whereas if I could use a little Chromecast that I don't have to think about and a little cylinder I don't have to think about and just sit down and say, show Mediterranean cruise photos, and it knows from the GPS tags what the heck I'm talking about because it's Google and it's really smart, and I didn't even have to make an album, that's a better experience. But you can only do that if you know where to get the photos from. And most people are not going to be sort of the self-hackers of like, well, my photos are on a free NAS thing in the basement, and I wrote a Linux server that pulls the thing. Like, no one's going to do that. Like, you can with the Amazon Echo, you can do those integrations. And in the beginning, that's kind of, it's impressive to create these Rube Goldberg machines. But I still feel like, especially in the silo world that we're in, ownership of data dictates what kind of things you can use it for. Like I said, in the same way that you cannot tell Google's thing to order you new fridge things, Amazon owns that. There's nothing Google can really do about that. Amazon's not going to be keen on letting Google integrate with its purchases in that way. So if that's one of the things that you want to do, and I think it is a useful thing to do, the only choice you have is the Amazon. And that's why I think we may be fated to be talking to multiple semi-intelligent assistants, referring to them by name in the same way that we go to multiple websites to do things. Like, go to Amazon when I'm shopping, but I go to, you know, Gmail when I want to do my mail. I say, Alexa, order me fridge filters, and I say, Google, do I have any appointments tomorrow afternoon? Because Google has my calendar and Alexa has my purchases. And again, if these little cylinders, like, they're cheap now, they're only going to get cheaper. If they're mostly network-based stuff combined with really good microphones and a tiny little low-power CPU that's always listening and stuff, I think that is, aside from any sort of global cooperation between these giant companies, which is not going to happen, talking to different things in our house seems to me the most likely outcome of all this. So I think we're all doomed to have multiple increasingly non-cylindrical cylinders. Like, eventually it'll just be a bunch of tiny little things that are dotted all over our house, and having multiple ones in them won't be a big deal.
Thanks so much to our three sponsors this week, Casper, Betterment, and Squarespace. And we will see you next week.
Now the show is over. They didn't even mean to begin, because it was accidental. Oh, it was accidental. John didn't do any research. Marco and Casey wouldn't let him, because it was accidental. Oh, it was accidental. And you can find the show notes at atp.fm. And if you're into Twitter, you can follow them at CASEYLISS. So that's Casey Liss, MARCOARMENT, Marco Arment, SIRACUSA, Syracuse. It's accidental.
We all saw each other earlier this week, actually. And Marco, this was your first probably multi-hundred mile trip in the Tesla. Is that right?
That is right. It's the longest trip I've taken yet, and the first trip that required a supercharger in the middle.
So how'd it go?
Before I bought the Tesla, the prediction I had was that this is going to be a car that's really nice in everyday use, to never have to like go to a gas station. And it's just going to be a bit of a pain in the butt when I go on long car trips, because I'm going to have these, like, you know, forced half-hour supercharger breaks every, like, 3 to 4 hours. and it's going to be a pain and everything else. But I figure like that'll be like I will tolerate that inconvenience for the awesomeness of the car in all other circumstances. So this is the first trip where I actually had to realize what it was like to rely on the supercharger network for your range. Because every other, I've gone to superchargers like twice in the past, but it was kind of optional. Like one time it was because it was just pouring rain and I was like, oh, I just need a break anyway. I'm passing one. So let me just take a break here. I'll go to a coffee shop or whatever. And the other time it was more, again, like, you know, similar, like not really necessary. Just stop for a few minutes. Anyway, this was the first time where I had to really stop for like 30 minutes. We pull up, we find them. It was the Delaware rest stop on 95 that, you know, everybody goes to. And there was like 12 spots and half of them were open. So that was fine. You know, pull up, plug in. And we went in, we all went to the bathroom and we all got, you know, a quick little lunch from the crappy food places they have in this wonderful Delaware rest stop. The food's the worst, but it's fine. Just don't go to the Baja Fresh because you think, oh, a Baja Fresh, that should be good because real Baja Fresh stores are good. But this is a Baja Fresh Express. And what that means is that it's a terrible, terrible pile of garbage that has the Baja Fresh sign above it. But that is not a real Baja Fresh. You never, ever get that. So, you know, we had lunch and everything. And before I knew it, like, we were just, like, doing, a basic rest stop. Before I knew it, my car was at, like, 98%. And I was, like, trying to rush out of there so I didn't hit 100 and start getting charged 40 cents a minute for sitting there taking up a spot unnecessarily.
Now, what were you at when you pulled in? Just ballpark?
Oh, I forget. I somewhere around, like, 30 or something. I don't know. Something like that.
Okay.
It was amazing, like, you know, charge up and like, so like we were stopping anyway, and you know, like if we were like one of those like hardcore long distance drivers that like the total time it takes you to get where you're going is very important to you and you don't like to stop at all, then this is not the car for you. But you know, if you stop anyway just like for basic comfort and to take a break, it's quite something else. On the way home, I had an even cooler experience. I was a little bit sick and I was really tired. I could really, really just use a break from driving. Like I was unreasonably tired just because of I was sick and, you know, anyway. Tiff and Adam went into Starbucks to get some coffee and to give Adam a sandwich. I sat in the car, left the heat on and left the heated seat on and just took a nap. I leaned the seat back.
Nice.
I took like a 20-minute nap. So here I was. I'm like, this is kind of amazing. So my car is filling up with the fuel it needs for free while I sit in a heated, nicely heated car with a nicely heated seat in the winter and take a nap. Actually, I think this is like the best car for like for long road trip comfort I've ever seen. Like, I thought this was going to be some kind of like big hassle on long trips. But it's only a hassle if you want to get there in the smallest amount of time possible. But if you are more leisurely, like we always have been, and you like to like stop for lunch, like, or you know, stop and take a break every so often, if that's your style of driving, this is the best. Like it is so much the best because it allows you to not only fill up for free and it forces you to take these breaks at certain intervals, but like the process of filling up for free is way nicer than stopping at a gas station. Oh my God, it's so actually, I really quite enjoyed it, and it was wonderful, and I look forward to future long trips where I have to use them.
That's awesome. That's somewhat surprising, but super cool.
Sounds like Tiff's new car is going to have even fewer miles on it than her old one.
Truth.
That'll be our beach house car.
Yeah, you still. Wow. That's the next bit of electric car anxiety that you have to get over just by doing it, because you're like, oh, it'll be sitting there and it'll be discharging and it shouldn't let it sit there for a week. I bet that's not a problem either. You got to try it.
Well, I remember I did the experiment. Like I left my car unplugged here when we went there to kind of try that, and it ended up, I think it loses like 1 or 2% a day, so it isn't that big of a deal. But no, the bigger problem is I don't want to fill my trunk with sand.
Oh. Jeez. Look, are you going to use your car or is it just a piece of, it's just a piece of art that you look at?
There are two things that are not allowed in my trunk: sand and glitter.
You can vacuum the sand up, I promise you.
Yeah, you know what? I was told that about the glitter in my trunk when we had a glitter heavy yeah, exactly. Yeah, so but sand,
but sand
comes
you
up?
Can.
No.
Do you have a trunk liner? I don't think I've ever seen your trunk.
What does that mean? It's covered in carpet. I don't know.
That's a no.
Right. So you can usually buy like a little rubber thing that goes in there so you can it, you know, it's mostly for like if like some groceries bang together and spill and get sticky stuff or whatever, that you basically, you don't ruin the carpet in your car. But also, if it gets filled with sand, you can take that whole rubber thing out, turn it upside down, dump all the sand back good, and put it in. But even if you do it right on the carpet, I promise you, you can vacuum sand out of carpeting in a car. It will be fine. And finally, sand in your car is a badge of honor if you are a beach person, which I know that you are not, but we're converting you, right?
I am a beach town person. I like the beach town. I like the beach environment. I like the beach mindset even. But I still do not like sand. Sand is a problem. And I don't see how glitter can be such the scourge of humanity that it is, and it can, like, glitter ruined my 328. Like, when I had that car, like, I got there was a that Christmas we brought my car upstate, and it was a year where the wrapping paper that was in use that year contained glitter, and the ribbon all contained glitter, and so my entire car filled with glitter. It never, like, I could not get it all out of that car. I eventually had to turn the car in for the end of the lease. It was still there. I turned in a glittery trunk at the end of the lease. I was not actually fined for that, but they should have fined me for that. Even I would have fined me for that.
You need to nip that in the bud. Like, I'm familiar with this phenomenon. Wrapping paper with glitter on the outside of it, just say no. That cannot enter your house. If someone else brings you a present with that on it, you have to, like, isolate it like it's radioactive. But by all means, when you're wrapping your own presents, do not choose that paper with glitter on it. That is a terrible mistake that should just never be allowed to happen. Setting aside cars, forget about cars, but just in your own home, that cannot be allowed to exist.
That caused a rule to be enacted that no more glitter in my car ever, and no glitter in any part of the house I care about, which is basically the office and my car.
Sand is not like that, I promise you.
But sand is just dull glitter. Like, how is that?
No, it is not. It's very small rocks.
How does that not work the same way?
And what else floats in water?
That's probably a reference that I'm not getting.
It is.
I can tell when you use your reference voice.
Yeah, you do have a reference voice.
Everybody else will get that. I could have tried to do the accent.
Oh, my goodness.